Well, a lot of stuff that I do isn't speed training. Do you know what I mean? We're not running, we're not doing loads of high speed work. A lot of it is taking the principles and applying it into the gym before pre and post training. It's applying it in start of sessions or start of rehab sessions. It's doing it in like a safe zone. And then when you build that behind you, then you can run fast and people aren't scared to run fast. But we're not using speed training as like straight into max velocity work for long periods of time.
Welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast, the podcast that dives into the philosophies, ideas, and practices of some of the best practitioners in high-performance sport. If you work in team sports, you're often looking to maybe track and field or other sports for inspiration and knowledge when it comes to speed training. So this episode is all about that transfer of knowledge and where people in soccer and other team sports go for that knowledge and depth of understanding. So we've got Tom Taylor, who is the head of performance at Rangers Football Club, who's previously been at West Ham, at Hearts and Brighton. And we discuss speed training from speed training in season to off season to those in rehab. And we discuss that transfer of knowledge. So where does he go and what does he translate to his environment? How does he do that? How do the guys at Rangers program speed training for rehab using the faster fit approach? How do they do it in season with the amount of games they've got? So if you're interested in speed training and you're in a team sport environment, this could be an absolutely superb episode for you. Tom is also speaking at the Sportsmith Speed Conference in Pittsburgh on the 1st and 2nd of June. So we'd love to have you there. If you're interested, head to sportsmith.co/events. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Vald. So I'm really proud to have Vald as a sponsor again, and after a recent visit to Vald HQ in Brisbane for their annual ValdCon event, it's incredible to see how far they've come as a company since I last visited at the start of 2018. So from a very humble office of less than 20 employees back then, it's amazing to see how far they've come. They now employ a global team of more than 200 that support clients across 100 countries, including many of the world's elite and professional sporting organisations. So an incredible rise to where they are now. So this is a huge testament to just the impact they're having across the industry with their innovation, but also continued commitment to support clients. So if you're a performance practitioner, you probably know all about Vald, but if not, I'd recommend that you check them out at valdperformance.com. This episode is also sponsored by TeamBuilder. TeamBuilder is a software for performance coaches around the world. The powerhouse platform increases efficiency, saves paper, and can handle any type of programming. It's the perfect fit for professional and academy teams, performance institutes, schools, and universities. TeamBuilder is full of tools that help coaches' needs. Multiple max tracking methods, 16 plus reports, evaluation testing, and goal setting, just to name a few. Coaches also have access to consultations with TeamBuilder's in-house sports scientist to help manage and analyze data. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code SPORTSMITH to start your 30-day free trial. So without further ado, over to the episode with Tom. Tom Taylor, welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, no, pleased to be here. Hopefully, have an interesting chat and see what comes out of it.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on. Firstly, super excited to have another UK representative at the Sportsman Speed Conference in Pittsburgh in just over 6 weeks now. So really excited to have you there and give a soccer football perspective. So
we're good. I want to lead. I thought it was really interesting. I enjoyed that one. So yeah, when you asked me to be part of the one in Pittsburgh, yeah, it was definitely something I was up for and interested to be part of. And the lineup looks great, doesn't it? So even just to be there and learn from the other guys that are going to be there as well. So that should be a good weekend.
Give us a teaser of what you're going to talk about.
So my talk will really just be about how we've applied some of the, I guess, the speed training principles to the soccer environments that I'm part of or have been part of. And how we've taken some of the ideas or the thoughts and actually translated into day-to-day environments or the weekly training plans or in busy periods of fixture congestion and along those lines really. So maybe slightly different talk to some of the other ones that are going to be there, because I guess other people might go into a bit more depth, a bit more detail in terms of some actual, you know, the proper speed training element, whereas I think my talk or my view will be more, okay, how can I take from that and put it into, you know, my environment, and hopefully that's something that people can take from and then maybe hopefully put into their own sort of practice as well.
Absolutely. We've got a few, I know it's MLS in season, but we have got a few, quite a few MLS clubs who are coming actually. I know Charlotte FC are bringing a couple of people, DC United, just a couple off the top of my head. So I'm sure they'll be super interested in your talk. So excited to have you there.
And to be hopefully it's not just soccer as well, Jim. Hopefully it's other team sports as well, because it's all sort of the same thing, isn't it? So it's just, yeah, the more I do it, the longer I'm in it, actually, yeah, you think less about the finer details, and sometimes you just take some of the bigger themes and then translate it into what you're doing, and before you know it, it's just getting people hopefully moving slightly better or feeling slightly better or moving slightly more efficiently. And actually that probably is translatable to every sport, isn't it, where everyone who's going to be there. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Nice, mate. Be a pleasure to have you. Right, let's have a little chat around, firstly, you. What's you're at Rangers, you're head of performance. Give us a bit of a story up until then, briefly.
Yeah, so, brief story. So probably I think it's my 13th season now for full-time football. 12th or 13th, along those lines anyway. So I studied sports science at Swansea many years ago now, and then was fortunate enough to go from there into an internship at West Ham. Turned straight into a first team sort of environment alongside a master's in research still at Swansea. So I was living in London and then heading back to Swansea every now and then just to keep up with that, which was great for me. Really good sort of first environment to be working in. So ended up staying at West Ham for 5 years in total. So sort of working, progressing each season really and doing a bit more throughout my time there. And then after 5 years, I just felt like I needed to, end up a slightly new environment or a new challenge. And because I started as an intern, by the time I left, my role was very different, but it still felt a little bit like, you know, like you needed to go somewhere else to really have an impact. So ended up going up to Hearts in Scotland, so as a head of fitness role there, which is, again, a different environment and something that was sort of exciting at the time.
Which when we first met?
That was when we first properly met. So yeah, that was a while ago, and actually still feels like a little while ago now. So I had 2.5 years there, which was great for me, actually. Like, I think at the time it was tough just because it was mainly just me trying to manage everything and do everything. Obviously, I had some help up there, but it was mainly really just me with the first team. So tough environment, but looking back, was probably the best thing I could have done for my own learning and my own development, I think. And actually, interestingly, every time I've had a chat about a new role or an opportunity, all the questions are around my time at Hearts. Do you know what I mean? It's never really about my time. Or subsequently, yeah, a lot of it's around that. Maybe just because it's my first head of role or along those lines, I don't know. But yeah, so a lot of the questions or people are interested in my time there. And then after 2.5 years there, the opportunity to go down to Brighton came up, Brighton and Hove Albion, back in the Premier League. So that was more as an S&C coach initially. And then that was gym and pitch space. And that over time developed into a lot of rehab, a lot of athletic development. And that was up until just before Christmas time. And then, yes, for the last three and a half months, I've been at Rangers as head of performance, which was, again, just an opportunity, really, just a chat or conversation that quickly turned into something a bit more. And then before you know it, yeah, packing your bags again and heading back up to Scotland. So, yeah, really enjoying it so far. Busy, very different role. A little bit less hands-on, but just sort of more a management role and more of an overseeing role, but no, it's been good. It's been it's a huge club, obviously with huge expectations. So just getting fully settled in there now, really. So yeah, a lot of the stuff we'll talk about will be more previous clubs rather than Rangers, just because I've only been here for a short amount of time so far.
Yeah. Right, you're going to tell me if I'm completely wrong here, but I'd love to give you my perspective of a rehab role or the people who occupy those rehab roles. I think it's fascinating. This is just based off the kind of content that we put out on Sportsmith and the interest it gets. You've got these S&C coaches who don't have any formalized qualification or experience, well, formalized qualification in the rehab space, but often get given end-stage rehab as part of the role, just as a given, because they're S&C coach.
Then you've got the physios on the other side, who obviously clinical, good at that side of things, but haven't got the experience on the maybe the programming and the S&C knowledge base. And then you've got this kind of convergence in the middle of this gray area when each are looking at the other one to kind of learn and progress. Is that, yeah. Does that, have I got that completely wrong? Is that just, is my perception relatively?
I guess, okay. No, I think you probably, that's probably that, I'm sure that'll be that in some environments. Yeah. I think my okay. experience of it, especially down at Brighton was a little bit different, I guess, maybe because we all got on really well down there in the sense that everyone was trusted each other and the communication was always really good and open and honest, that like it was never really, yeah, I never really felt like I was stuck in the middle of anywhere, or that I was, you know, either taking things on too early or people were hanging on to things too long. It kind of all felt like it worked quite well, but I can definitely understand, yeah, where you're coming from. And
yeah, and I was thinking about the knowledge, like each looking to the other for knowledge, because the other ones are like in this gray area of the rehab process, there's a gap for each one. So each one's looking at the other for a bit of guidance and a bit of help.
Yeah, completely. And I think, but then I think as long as like you have those conversations and you can sort of plan those things together, then I think typically that works quite well. Yeah, and obviously, okay. The longer you work with each other, then before you know it, actually, you can sort of, yeah, you can take them on earlier because you know what they would be doing anyway. Or actually, the physios, they'll take more of the work that they see you doing with the players. So actually, you know, so by the time they come to you, they're already doing that sort of work. And actually, that becomes a bit more of a natural process, I guess. But no, definitely, I can see where. It would be like a bit of a gray zone in the middle where people are just sort of not stuck, but in there. But like, yeah, I don't have a official rehab certificate or qualification as such. But I think the longer you're in it, the more cases you're exposed to, the more times you know return players, like you have a bank of knowledge and you've made enough mistakes to know, you know, when to push or when to pull or when to just ask for help and all that sort of thing. I think it's something I always try and do as well, as ask for people's opinions and ask for like, look, I'm thinking this or I'm struggling with this. What do you think? And before you know it, actually, it becomes normal to say, look, I need a bit of help or I've seen this or, you know, I'm not quite sure about this. Because I think if you don't ask for the help and it goes wrong, then I know personally, I'd be like, I should have asked for help there or should have raised this at the time, because ultimately the rehab case or the person that you're trying to work with is the most important thing in that scenario. So, yeah, I think the environment down there was really, yeah, I learned a huge amount down there and I was really hands-on down there. So like I was involved with all sorts, do you know what I mean? So I think after a while doing that, you do build your own ideas and thoughts. And, you know, when you do see certain things, you know, actually that's a bit of a worry or that's a bit of a concern, or actually a lot of the time it's not, but you just need to convince them that it's not, or you need to, you know, break down any sort of barrier or fear from the athlete themselves or the physios or other people that you're working with, because ultimately I think like, yeah, the longer you do it, the more confidence you have in that process.
For an S&C coach, that's, sorry, I'm peppering your questions here. There's so much to get from you. For an S&C coach that's interested in that area because they've, you know, been given a few rehab cases and they kind of want to become that rehab specialist, which is becoming more and more prevalent, especially at the kind of level that you're working with, what would be the advice that you'd give them? Just like get in there and get stuck in and learn, or is there any other avenues that you went that helped you along the way?
I think like asking questions is always really like important, and also being around the physios or the athletes at the early stage of rehab is really helpful as well. If you can, it's difficult because you've also got your own job to be doing and your own athletes to be working with, but when you can be around them and when they're less mobile or when there's more restrictions on them, then I think that's really helpful because you do learn a bit more in terms of the physiology or looking at the scans or looking at, you know, surgeon's notes or scan reports, whatever it might be. Like you do learn a lot from that, and you hear words and you put two together, and then before you know it, you're sort of, you're getting a good idea of what you think or, you know, what you might see as the next few weeks of that rehab, etc. In terms of resources, like there's loads out there now, isn't there? To be honest, there's loads of good people out there that are putting really good stuff out. I know you've done a lot of stuff with like Alan Murdoch, there's a lot of things that, you know, when he talks, I think makes sense to me about like, you know, focusing on certain areas or thinking about certain things and not just focusing on the injury itself. Because I think sometimes it's quite easy to just focus on what's actually broken or what's gone wrong, whereas actually you can spend a lot of time around that rather than getting too bogged down on just exactly what the injury is. But yeah, I think asking questions is always a really good one. Obviously, you know, you need to ask them at the right time and, you know, and have a good relationship with a physio or whoever it is that you're working with. But that's probably how helped me get from more of a fitness coach role to a S&C role to a rehab role to back into a sort of a head of performance role now, is asking those questions, because now I'm getting asked questions from the manager or from a higher up or whoever it might be about injuries or whatever it might be. And I need to have a good knowledge of that and a good understanding of that to be able to translate the chats from the medical meeting that afternoon or my own experiences or my own knowledge of what we're going through. But also, it's a difficult one, but don't be afraid to make mistakes as well, because that's definitely how I've learned. But in the rehab process, that's not always an easy place to make mistakes, because obviously that's not what you want to do. But they will happen, and that's always going to be the case. It's just making sure you reflect on those and think, oh, missed that, or should have thought about that, or there was a few warning signs there, which often there are. It's just whether you have the confidence or the time to be able to, you know, always take a step back and think again. But yeah, that would be my main thing, would be to ask questions really and to put yourself around people that can, you know, teach you things or help you in that process.
This is such a low level question, but I'd love to ask it because it'd be an interesting story if you're happy to share it. What's the biggest mistake you made in rehab? Don't have to mention names or anything.
Yeah,
like
no,
that.
It's a good question.
Is there
any
big ones?
If I'm being completely honest, and like, there's nothing in rehab side, there's not one that really stands out where I've gone, you idiot. There's ones where they've gone really well, and then like you maybe miss a little something, but you get away with it, and in hindsight, you go, I'm not doing that again. And so, and then you get away with it. There's not been loads where it's gone wrong and you've gone, oh, I missed that. But they've not all gone right. But then when you reflect, sometimes you maybe wouldn't necessarily change too much, or, you know, you were quite happy with a lot of it and there was maybe certain elements that you would change, but there's nothing huge in that. Obviously, working with fit players, there's mistakes I've made before, huge mistakes I've made before, and obviously they go wrong and you go, and you feel like an idiot and you reflect on it for ages, and then ultimately you come out of the other side and you're better for it, because you don't, or you try and avoid it again, or you try and think about what you would do differently. I think the rehab side of things, I think the most important, as long as you've got a really good reason or a good why for what you're doing, and then I think you're going to be okay, really. Do you know what I mean? There's a I'm doing this because of this, or I'm not doing this because of this, and then before you know it, you're confident in what you're doing and there's a reason why you're doing what you're doing. If you take it step by step, normally you get there in the end. But there'll definitely be some that, you know, along the way I've got ahead of myself with or made a mistake with, and I'm sure there'd be ones that I'll think about tonight after this chat where I've gone, oh, that would have been a good one, or I forgot about that. But yeah, like, and also one thing I do try and do as well now is if I have made a mistake, I try and make sure people know I've like recognized it as well. Do you know what I mean? Or if something's gone wrong, I'm trying to go, well, I missed that or got that wrong. More just that other people feel safe to say the same thing, or other people don't feel too afraid to make mistakes, or, you know, to admit when they need the help, because we're all going to need help. We're all going to need to ask questions at some point. So definitely something I try to do now when sort of managing a department or leading that area, is to make sure people feel comfortable to go, yeah, that was a mistake, or I got that wrong. So yeah.
Thank you for that. Appreciate that. So let's dive into the first point that we were going to, well, plan to chat about, which is the demands of football at the Premier League level. And let's extend that to Scottish Premier League as well, given the where you're at now. So what are we dealing with?
Yeah, so I think what we're dealing with, we're dealing with a calendar or a schedule that's getting busier and busier. We're dealing with athletes that are getting bigger and faster and stronger, and I've been asked to do that every 3 days for a whole 12-month period now, a lot of them. And like, so the game is getting quicker, and we've seen that over a longer period of time now. So I think what we're dealing with is we're dealing with people who have been asked to go, you know, really high demanding 100-minute games now, with the games are getting longer as well. So there's less time for them to recover and turn around and be asked to go again. So what we're trying to do now is we're trying to help create players who can do their job three times a week, and their job's getting harder and harder, really. So we've seen in terms of the actual outputs, people are covering more than 1,000 meters of the high intensity stuff, plus 400 meters of sprint, and then doing that three times a week, and there were huge mechanical loads as well. And we see that in Scotland also, that's Premier League and up in Scotland, the figures are similar really from what I've seen so far. And also now we're seeing that the best players in the world are also the best athletes in the world. So they're the ones that are having, it's now not just the case of the best players are the best players, but they're also now the ones who are most robust and the ones who can do it for their country, for their club, right to the, you know, to the later stages of all the tournaments and the competitions. So I think with that in mind, the demand is so high on these guys. And I think it's our job now, hopefully, to create environments where they can, yeah, they can prepare themselves for that, or we can help them prepare for that. And then the work we do in between games is appropriate to also help them develop, but equally help them recover. So that's also a fine balance in terms of what we're doing and what we're having to think about, I guess, on a daily basis.
So what's the contrast like between the Scottish Premier League and the Premier League?
We had sort of chatted a little bit before about this at the start. In terms of the actual figures, like some of the running outputs we have up here are huge. Up in Scotland, they're massive, and I guess you might think that the Premier League is going to be like way ahead of everything else, but I think from my experience in the Premier League, the playing style is so important in that as well. So in terms of how the team sets up will demand a little bit in terms of what the physical outputs are going to be. Some games are really open where obviously you're watching it going, how are they going to keep doing this for that whole game? Or some games are a lot more structured, then it's like on the transition and then recovering from that and going again. So up here in Scotland, the games are a little bit different, but the outputs are huge still. And again, it ranges the schedules and the demands are massive. So for us, it's a similar sort of demand. We're preparing them for the same sort of thing. So that's kind of, I've not seen a big difference really between the two so far. All I've seen so far up at Rangers is, like I said, the schedule is so busy and so dense. With expectations to get again to the later stages of all the tournaments and to win every game, that the demand on these guys are through the roof really. So our job is to hopefully, like I said at the start, just prepare them for that and help turn them around every few days so they can go out and do that again. But from starting in football 12, 13 years ago to what it is now is huge when you watch the game and you watch the speed of the play and you watch them now, they stop and then they burst into action again, and they're doing that throughout the whole duration of the game. There's never really a lull in the tempo. There's never really a pause in the game. It's kind of, when you watch it from the sidelines of the high-level games, it's impressive in terms of what they've been asked to do. So then, it's up to us really just to provide that environment to get them ready for that, which isn't easy, because also those guys, they don't really have a break, so they don't really have a time to necessarily train or to prepare, because they're either away with their countries, or they're in a tournament or whatever else it might be. So I think that's where, sort of having your own philosophy, your own principles is important, because then when you do have time, you sort of stick to those, or you try and put those in place. It's maybe different if you do have more time and then there's more sort of free weeks. But I think my experience is now, when time is limited, it's kind of like, what's the most important thing for this individual or for this group of individuals, and make sure that's done. And then if we have other time, then great, we can maybe look at another couple of things. But really, just having that routine or that habit for them is the most important thing. And I've seen that actually, that's probably over the last few years, that's probably what I've really enjoyed, is like creating those habits and routines, so that actually players become a bit more self-sufficient, or and they sort of have a good understanding of what they need to do and when they need to do it and why they need to do it. So that hopefully then they are able to keep, performing and meeting the demands that is being asked of them, which is only going to go, it's only going to go one way really, which is getting more and more and more. So I think that's probably a really important part of our jobs as well.
So let's keep it speed training related. And I think this next question, that our discussion, I think will be super, super interesting, because I think track and field, obviously creating the fastest people on the planet, other sports, NFL, soccer, what basketball have looked previous to these guys for knowledge to make fast athletes. So how do you, as a practitioner in football, transfer that knowledge that has been honed in different sports, but bring it and make it your own? And like you say, that's going to be the one of the points you're going to speak about in Pittsburgh, but I'd love to get your kind of overall thoughts before we dive a little bit deeper.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, to be honest, for this, I think one thing that was really good for me in the sort of lockdown period, when all the information was coming out and all the you know, the people, different people, and obviously yourself putting loads of good stuff out in terms of different practitioners and their opinions. And a lot of it comes from maybe college sports or university sports or some of those programs as well, where you can see what they're looking to achieve and why. But I guess why the reason why I sort of like this approach, or why to me it's really helpful or beneficial, is because although it's speed training or the speed training principles, really just about developing good movement or developing, you know, structures that are helpful and helping to hopefully make movement a bit more efficient and make things feel a bit easier. And ultimately, I think that's, no matter what sport you're working in, that's going to be helpful. And I mean, you hear different people talk and they might be talking about a track and field event, or they might be talking about an American football environment or whatever it might be. A lot of that stuff, when you break it down, you can put into your environment. So I think for me, it's kind of, and it's taken me a lot of time to get to a place where I'm quite comfortable now, or quite confident in that approach, because at the start it was all alien to me and it was all very new and there was a lot of things that was sort of going over my head. Whereas now, like, the more you've done it, or the more times you've sort of spent with athletes or cases you've worked with, I guess my vision now has narrowed a little bit. So at the start it would have been huge, and there would have been loads of things that would have been a lot for me to take in, whereas now actually, yeah, there's a few things that I'll focus on. So a lot of stuff around the hips, the knees and the ankles, and try and start there. And then there's normally things there that are sort of quite apparent, and then you can delve into that a little bit. Whereas at the start, I'd have looked at everything. I'd have been looking at absolutely everything going on and going, not sure what I'm seeing. Whereas now, like, after doing it for longer and seeing more things, I'm more confident in just going, right, now there's that. And then because I'm seeing that, I'm probably going to see that. And then before you know it, yeah, there's a few things there that are, you know, really a nice starting point to build on. Obviously, a lot of the research that's done isn't in soccer or football. But I think, like I said, the principles are all very similar. So I think that's probably the biggest thing that I've taken or learned over the last few years. And again, asking questions. Do you mean reaching out to people and asking things and asking how they're translating it into their environment? Or you've only got 20 minutes to work on what you're picking and why are you choosing that? A lot of stuff that James Wiles has done, you know, with rugby players has been great. And that's huge detail. Do you mean there's loads and loads of detail in that? So if you can pick things out of that and add a few things into, you know, in terms of what you're seeing in your group of players, then before you know it, there's a few things there that help or give you a good starting point. And typically as well, when you do chat to the players you're working with, like, they'll mention things as well. Do you mean they'll mention things they're feeling, or I don't feel great doing this, or I've noticed recently something, and then actually they all link quite nicely. So that again gives you a little bit of confidence to go, recognize what I'm seeing is, you know, I think is right. And then you slow things down and you get some footage and things, and then before you know it, your philosophy becomes a little bit stronger because you're more confident in what you're seeing. But I think, I think to go back to the original question, a bit off track there, but like, yeah, there's a lot of things from a lot of different sports and a lot of different environments, but good movement is good movement. And if the best athletes at those really demanding tasks are able to do all that, then there's no reason why I can't take bits from that and put it into my working environment. I guess the biggest thing working in the soccer environment or the team sport environment might be what sort of selling it to the player or selling it to the environment or selling it to other people that you're working with, because speed training obviously has a bit of a stigma attached to it or a bit of a fear attached to it because of speed training. But actually a lot of it
is that still the case, Tom?
Well, a lot of stuff that I do isn't speed training. Do you know what I mean? We're not doing loads of high speed work. A lot of it is taking the principles and applying it into the gym before pre and post training. It's applying it in start of sessions or start of rehab sessions. It's doing it in like a safe zone. And then when you built that behind you, then you can run fast and people aren't scared to run fast. But we're not using speed training as like straight into max velocity work for long periods of time. It's more just taking out like the important bits and then over time building up a bank so that actually when they do go fast, then there's no worry there because they've done it. Do you know what I mean? And then it's safe to do it. But I guess there'll always be a bit of fear attached to that. Yeah. I think it's breaking down and it's less. But all it takes is something to go wrong, and then that fear comes back again across the whole environment. But I think as long as you've built up towards that, then that should all be gone. And I guess we might come onto it a little bit anyway in terms of the rehab stuff. But one of the biggest things, or my biggest, one of the reasons why I like this approach I use it a lot is because actually I think it builds confidence anyway. So when people feel confident running fast, they feel confident to open their legs regularly, then actually we are building confidence in the athlete as well. So I think that's always a big part of what we do.
So I'm just going to take a very quick break in the chat with Tom. Hope you're enjoying part one. So I'm just going to take this opportunity to remind you of the Sportsmith Speed Conference in Pittsburgh on the 1st and 2nd of June, where Tom is a speaker alongside Stu McMillan, Les Spellman, Cam Joss, Jonas Dodu. The list goes on and on. So if you're interested, head to sportsmith.co/events. You will see our speed conference as well as our rehab conference there. So the speed conference is going in 5 weeks, and we'd love to have you there. This episode of the Pace to Performance podcast is sponsored by Rockdaisy. Rockdaisy's athlete management system provides a powerful competitive advantage to elite sports leagues around the world. If you're looking for a solution that enables you to centralize, analyze, and visualize your data, check out rockdaisy.com and sign up for a free trial. And now back to the episode with Tom.
So do you have any particular principles that you stick to that you may have honed from an Alan or a Jonas or a James that you've then manipulated and made your own in a football environment?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's probably a few things. So I've spent a lot of time with Jonas, been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with Jonas Dodo over the last few years. So he came down to Brighton a few times to help out with a few cases, and we keep in touch a lot now. He actually came up to Rangers a few weeks ago to give a CPD day to the group, which is great. So one of the things that we talk about a lot there is if I talk about the hips, the knees and the ankles, that's kind of where I look in that order. And then when I'm cueing things, especially in the gym or outside, a lot of it will just be a case of pulling down with a heel rather than just collapsing to the floor. A lot of the case will be keeping our toes up in the air so we can pull down and attack the ground a little bit. So we're not just collapsing and waiting to hit the floor and feeling tall and feeling bouncy. And a lot of the cues that we'll do will all be the same. So we'll probably think about those three main things. And I'll talk about that in a bit more detail, I guess, when we're out in America. But when working with, I guess, team sport athletes or definitely athletes that I've worked with before, when you're cueing them or when you're doing some drilling work with them, they're very passive in those environments. So it's more just trying to get them involved in it, get them feeling like they're in it, is how I describe it. So especially in the rehab stuff, I want you to feel like you're in it. So you're not just going through the motions. You're not just sort of waiting to stop yourself from falling over. You're actually part of what we're doing. And the more they do that, then actually the easier things feel. And then before you know it, you're up and running. I think when Alan talks a lot about the faster fit approach, I really agree with that as well. And I've seen that a number of times. So that's when he talks, rather than necessarily just building up higher volumes at lower level work, you probably start the other way and you're starting drilling quite early, maybe low volumes of it, but over time that grows and the intensity grows, and before you know it, you're actually well on your way to being closer to returning to training and competition. Because I've seen with joint injuries, with muscle injuries, that actually you can get away with the low level stuff early on, but as soon as you start to add in the extra or the more demanding work, you're sort of starting from scratch again. Whereas I think I found that when you can start add that type of work in early, when you get closer to returning, they've got such a good bank of good work under the belts that they're much in a much safer place to return. So those are probably the main things that I've taken and then adjusted and added into my own environments that I've kind of found to be quite successful. And also I think when I was younger, or even more recently, I think you sometimes feel a bit of pressure to vary things quite a lot, join and keep things interesting and change things up, and you always get told you need to change things regularly, the athletes get bored, you need to make it fresh. Whereas actually my experience more recently has probably been the opposite of that, in the sense that if you can create those, like I said a little while ago, those routines or those habits, and the athletes understand them and they feel the benefits of them, then if they've got a bit of time, they come and they do that, and then they let outside be the variance, they let the training and the games be the things that are changing up and that are more challenging. Whereas I think of course, we need to challenge them and push them to improve, but there comes a point where actually they're playing and they're training all the time, and my job is to do the work in between that's going to help them continue to do that. So rather than necessarily try and change it for the sake of changing it, they get it, they can do it well, They can do it on their own, all these sorts of things, and I'm quite happy with that. But again, me 2-3 years ago, that would be different. I'd have felt like I need to change that, or you know, look every 4 or 5 weeks and try and find a different variant. Whereas now I think I'm more confident saying, no, it's this type of training day today, so you're doing this, or big spaces today, so we're doing this, and they just sort of get on with it now and no questions asked. So so that's also sometimes a nice bit of feedback from them. Do you know what I mean? If there's no pushback, or there's no like no negative feedback from those guys, then typically that means something's going all right. But again, yeah, that's taken time and experiences and getting things wrong along the way to know what I'm comfortable with or what I think is sort of beneficial.
I've always thought about the variation side of things. I mean, there's certain things. I think Boo Scheck-Snyder, I mean, in the podcast a while ago, and you'll meet him in Pittsburgh. Variation is the mother of injury prevention, something like that. But that was in a particular area. That doesn't mean everything. Doesn't mean everything has to change. It always interests me when people say that. And obviously you're saying something quite the opposite when it comes to this particular aspect. But is it the athlete that gets bored, or is it the coach that gets bored?
Yeah. That's probably a good point. I mean, that's probably a really good point then. But there's also times I've been in good places and I've changed it, and then you've had a bit of a negative response to that for whatever reason. Then you go, okay, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But it's also, but that doesn't mean you don't do it. Maybe I probably did it at the wrong time. Do you know what I mean? Or maybe I changed it too much too soon or whatever. So it's never a case of me sticking to what I'm sticking to because that's all I know or that's what I'm safe with. It's more thinking like I've tried to change things for the sake of changing it, whereas the actual work being done is very similar. So unless there's a very different, if I'm looking for a very different response, then of course I need to change it. But if I'm looking to prime them for what they're about to go and do, and I know that this individual athlete has a history of this, this, and this, and I know that when he's fatigued, we see this in, you know, in the chain or differences in certain movements, then I'm really sort of quite comfortable now to keep those things as they are. But again, because of that, I'm also quite conscious that I have to reflect on that, and I can't just get comfortable and just go, no, you're keeping it the same because we're keeping it the same and I can't be bothered changing it. It's more like, okay, right, let's review it. Let's see what needs to happen, or do I need to think about changing things? And if so, then yeah, of course, let's do it. If not, then, you know, I might not chase that. Or that'll be a longer term process. I think with that as well, that when you get to know the individuals in the team, like you'll know what... It's quite interesting when you're doing some of the drills pre-training, there'll be certain things in certain athletes which are like warning signs, or you know, when you start to see things, you go, well, that's a bit different today, or I see that after big days, or I see that when he's not quite with it, or he's not quite fully present, or etc. And then actually that's quite nice, because then you go, right, come on, let's go again, or right, let's focus now. But again, that takes time.
Can you give an example of that, Tom? Because I know that's something that Jonas has spoken about and will speak about in Pittsburgh as well. But I'd be interested.
So when you not just rehab, but working with fit players too, when you're doing whether it's pre-training prep, some acceleration prep that we do against the wall, or whether it's banded, or whether it's more high speed stuff in terms of box switches or rebounds, whatever else it might be, you can normally see. There's a few that spring to mind. There's one that. Some of the acceleration stuff, like we talk about sort of making big shapes, right? And the acceleration, we want that first big step to be nice and big, and then to help hit the floor and then set you on your way. And when he's not quite there, or if he's maybe slightly tired from whatever's been done, like those first few steps are just, they're way smaller than what we want them to be. And he just sort of falls and collapses into it. And then before you know it, you're not getting what you need to get. So right, go and slow down, think about it, start again. And then as soon as you cue it, to be fair, a couple of times, actually it's fine. It's just maybe sometimes refreshing and keeping on top of them. There's a few that really extend through the lumbar spine, and really like they stay tall, but they stay tall and they sort of cheat. Whereas actually, okay, right, think about it. Right, let's go back to this. Let's maybe work around the pelvis a little bit more, then go back into it, and then they're fine. Or there's some that really cast out in front of them, and you go right, think right, go and add a bit more resistance in terms of maybe the run rocket or the acceleration work that we do, and then actually again they're fine. But there's a few things there that you go, right, now that's your one thing that I know is really like prevalent in the way you move, or that's something that I'm always going to look out for you as an individual. But that'd be so different across the squad, or and so different across the 6, 7, or 8 that I'm working with on that day, or however it might look. But that's where the rehab side is really nice, because then you have that time with them, so when they go back in, like, you know what you're looking for. So that's quite a privileged position, really. It was a really good role for me to have at Brighton, because it meant that you're just part of that whole process. So that when they go back in, like you just feel so much safer, so much more confident, because you know them so well, and you're confident in the work that's been done with them. And again, that goes back from at the start. I was probably looking at 10 or 12 different things, whereas now I'm looking at much less than that. Just in terms of like, okay, right, that's important for me, or that's important for him. But again, and I've said it a few times, like it's only because I've been in those environments enough times to have seen it or to make mistakes or to have done that you feel more confident doing it. So yeah, like you asked earlier, what advice for people, I guess it would be, no matter who you're working with or no matter what level, like just asking them to spend time with an athlete or an individual and asking them to do a few movements or a few drills and looking at it and going away, maybe filming it and looking at your own time, I think you'll start to see things and you'll start to have a good understanding of what you're looking at and why.
With the faster fit approach, I mean, Alan's been on numerous times and that's come up a lot, and he's done a couple of Q&As for us as well on this approach. Is there anything that Alan's kind of refined in his environment that you've taken and gone, love that, and I'm just going to tweak this. This is how I think about this area and put it into the football environment with your players. Is there anything that comes to mind when I say that you could explain?
I think maybe how I plan my typical sessions would be that the first part I would always, not always, but when if we're working on the drilling or the mechanics, whatever it might be in that session, and it wouldn't be every session, it would be, you know, when the right time of the week and when that's the right sort of outcome that we're looking for. So I'd always include some of the bleeds, the dribble bleeds, the scissors, the pogos, all that sort of stuff, and have a good bank of that for the first 15-20 minutes. And that stays quite stable throughout the process. And all I'd really do in that process is I'm cueing more at the start, and then throughout the process I'm asking the athlete to just sort of show me so they get a good understanding, and then to sort of increase the distances or the reps or the speeds and everything else. And then we'll go into all of our more football specific type work with the physical stuff intertwined in that, which I guess is similar to some of the work that Alan puts out and online, and I've seen him talk about before. And he talks about the tempo work and all that sort of stuff, which I think all makes sense to me. I think the one of the biggest things for me on that, so it's not necessarily really about his approach, but one of the biggest things I've seen when doing the faster fit approach is like, no matter what the injury is, sort of as I said earlier, but because I've had experiences of working with athletes with long-standing knee injuries or ankle injuries, and you might not necessarily think about like speed training for those as such, because you think, maybe you're thinking more for that as a hamstring or a rec fem, or maybe more of a soft tissue injury. And actually, if you can get those athletes with joint issues used to hitting the floor with more force more regularly, then actually those joints become more accustomed to that. So that when they go back into their environment, the shot is less shock. Do you know what I mean? The difference between what they're exposed to with me and what they're going into with the team is much more similar. So I've actually seen really nice like examples where people have had sort of grumbly ankles for a while and not really done much of this type of work, but trained or have got through training or got through a few games, but still grumbly. Whereas actually, if you're able to add in a few isolated bits inside and outside, then before you know it, those grumbles seem to disappear, or they become less. And I think that's similar to that faster fit approach. And I think it's definitely something that I've taken, maybe adjusted a little bit, or maybe not. Maybe it's something I've thought about anyway. And actually, Alan's just spoke about it more, and actually, it's made me feel more. Yeah, it makes sense to me. Maybe more along those lines, really. But he's not. Alan's not someone I've spoken to much. I'd like to speak to him a bit more and probably pick his brains a bit more on that anyway. But yeah, the faster fit approach. And even when they're doing the positional specific work as well with the ball, do you mean in their areas of the pitch and doing their job with me before they do it with the team, but they're doing it with me, we'll still include the same sort of work as well, making sure that the volumes are right and intensities are right, and we're not just doing big volumes of low level work. It's always going to be good level work, and then we'll build the volume of that rather than necessarily just trying to go and hit a 6 kilometer session for the sake of hitting a 6 kilometer session. I'd rather hit less than that at a good level and then over time build that up. So then again, that's if you have the time to do it. Not always, you don't always have the time to do that. Of course, there's different pressures and different timescales available. But I think when you have the time to be able to do that, I think it's something that's been really beneficial. Adding that structure at the start of the sessions in particular. And then before you know it, the athlete feels comfortable doing it, confident doing it. And probably the biggest thing in that as well is like when you're able to add some of this work in with the players you're working with, and they start to feel, you know, a bit more bouncy, a bit more springy, and things feel a little bit easier. Like they'll suddenly hit, and you ask them to hit a 75% stride, they'll probably go at 85% because it feels easier. Do you know what I mean? And they go, no way, that's 85%. Actually, then you go, no, it was, because, you know, maybe you're moving slightly better, or you felt, you know, feel a bit more comfortable, whatever it might be. And actually, over time, they feel way more confident in those environments. And you'll often hit like new speeds in those environments just because you've given them a space to prepare for that and space to build up towards that, which I think with a faster fit approach you get. If it's the other way around, you probably don't get that, because what happens is you spend the first few weeks of rehab achieving low level work, and then before you know it, you're nearly at the end of your time scale, and then you're trying to squeeze all of that last the most dangerous part in the last 2 weeks, when actually really you could have built up a huge bank of work before you get there. So that's probably definitely one of the biggest learnings I've made over the last couple of years, looking at this approach. Because if it's a 6 week injury, like you have to really think about getting them back in the 6 weeks. You can't necessarily go, oh, actually, no, I should have done this a lot earlier. Whereas actually, you probably can do a lot of that work earlier. And then by the time you get to the last week or so, you don't have to worry about chasing big volumes because they've done decent volumes with decent work. You can really just go after the last part that you need to tick off, which is often the really high intensity work or the really high speed work or the really dense football work, whatever it needs to be. You're not having to try and squeeze all of it into the last session or two before they go back in, and then hoping that they get through rather than necessarily having like developed a nice sort of process throughout the whole rehab.
My last question for you, and it's around individualization and positional needs. How much variation is there amongst the squad? And let's use a rehab sense. You've got a central defender coming back from a hamstring injury, and you've got a right winger coming back from a hamstring injury. How much difference is there? Because my take and my assumption is that probably maybe a younger coach may get bogged down in that kind of individualization and how much the demands of the game are going to impact what happens. But is that the case in the real world with someone a bit more experienced?
I'll still go along that it is different.
Okay.
I think,
yep.
I think, well, it's different in the sense of what you're preparing them for is different.
Maybe of course.
So maybe some of the work that you're doing is quite similar in the sense of you're still preparing them to go back in and play the sport. I think it's obviously just depending on what their job is. Do you know what I mean? And we've seen that a lot. And actually, interestingly as well, like it might be you've got two right backs in the squad, but actually both right back, the right backs are very different. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like physical profiles and outputs and demands. So you might be working with a right back, but that right back might be very different to the other right back. So actually then when you have a good idea of what their individual demands in the game are and the job that the manager wants them to do and what they're expected to do, then that's the end point. That's what you're trying to get to. And then you sort of work backwards from that is how I would describe it and how I would sort of suggest people look at it, because it's not just distances that they hit, it's number of efforts, it's time above certain speed, it's time between efforts, it's all that sort of stuff that if you're able to delve into that much detail, you can do some really, really good work and throughout the rehab process. Because I've definitely been involved in times when actually they've hit their sprint distance in the game, but they've done it in two efforts, they've done two long sprints and they've hit it, but in reality in the game they're doing it over 12 or 14 short efforts, you know, with short time between each effort, and that's very different to what I've just prepared them for by doing two 70 meter sprints, whatever it might be. So again, having a good idea of, you know, what they're doing in the game is going to really, I think, should influence how you're approaching your rehab plan and what you're trying to achieve in that, and how the last week looks and what the difficult day looks like. And also the actual football work is going to be different, because it's going to be, you know, you're going to try and make it as specific to them as possible, with the physical bits in between. Hopefully that might look a little bit more similar, but you just play around with the volumes and that's probably how I would suggest. In the gym and the prep stuff, that might be very similar, to be fair, you know, and as long as that might look more similar than some of the pitch work. But again, hopefully you've got a good idea of what their weaknesses are or what they need to work on, in which case that will probably guide it a little bit as well. So yeah, there's I would probably still try and individualize it as much as possible, where possible, obviously depending on the environment you're in and what you have access to, just because I think you're going to return that individual back to training. So it's, you're not returning you're not just returning a central midfielder to training, you're returning that central midfielder to training, and you know that the training looks like this for them, you know the games look like this for them, you know that he's going to play as soon as he's back and available, or you know actually he might not start for a little while, so he's got a couple of weeks of training and under his belt. All those things are part of the decision. And now at a club like Rangers, when you're playing every 3 days and every game you have to win, then those decisions become more difficult as well, because like it's just an environment where you need all your players available to win every game. So now as a head of performance, I'm probably asking questions of the people doing the rehab, that when I was doing the rehab, I was like, leave me alone. Do you know what I mean? But it's just, that's kind of, well, hopefully now I've got a good understanding, I can empathise with those guys a bit more, and hopefully have a good idea of when to hopefully push a bit, or actually know we need to take our time here and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I've definitely found already in the last few months, you start asking questions that you go, if I was that person, I'd be raging at the moment. But it seems to be how it is. But yeah, the individualization and going back to that, I think when you can do it, it's definitely something that needs to be done, because yeah, it's just the most successful rehab cases I think I've had have been the ones where you can really delve into it in good detail, and you're able to plan things accordingly and work up towards the game. And I'll talk about this in America a lot, like the game is always the most important thing. Their job that they do is the most important thing. So we're just preparing them to do that job, hopefully to go back and do it slightly better if possible, but that's their job. So and their roles are very different to the people in the team. So we have to be conscious of that and always keep that sort of central to everything that we're doing. Which again, when you add in the football stuff, then it becomes easier, because you're adding in, they're just doing their job, but they're doing it with you. Do you know what I mean? And they might start over a smaller space, then becomes a bit bigger and a bit faster and a bit more of it. But hopefully when they go back into the team environment, it's just the same. It's the same stuff as they've been doing with me, but they're just surrounded by other players rather than just me. Do you know what I mean? So that's probably how I would approach things as well.
Perfect. Well, I said 45 minutes, so we're pretty much bang on. But anyone that wants to know more about you, Tom, you're not a particularly social media guy. LinkedIn the best place for you?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think you've asked me to put a few things out on social media, so you probably haven't made too many tickets.
Obviously, you're all good. It's fine.
But yeah, LinkedIn, anything that sort of you've got questions, fire over to me. Yeah, and I'll always be happy to help and help out. Like I think, just coming through myself the last how long, 10, 12 years, I've always learned a lot from asking people and reaching out. So, and I still do now. Do you know what I mean? Like I've always found it really helpful, especially now and in my new role, reaching out and speaking to people. So, please do any questions you've got, reach out, and I'll try and do my best to reply as soon as I can.
Perfect. Right. I'll see you in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Right end of May. But thank you very much. Really appreciate your time for the last 45 minutes, an hour. And look forward to seeing you over there.
Cheers, Rob. See you soon.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for tuning in to episode 493 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. Really appreciate Tom jumping on. I know he doesn't do these type of things very often, so I really appreciate him diving into what he does at Rangers and what he's learned along the way in his career when it comes to translating knowledge of speed training. So big thanks to Vald, to Team Builder and Rock Daisy for sponsoring this episode today. The podcast could not run in its current form without these guys, so I really do appreciate all their support. And if you are interested in the Sportsmith Speed Conference in Pittsburgh on the 1st and 2nd of June, head to sportsmith.co/events and you will see the conference and all the information there. Look forward to chatting to you next time. Bye-bye.